Interview with General Marshall, November 19.
You have put it over. And then I went into it. My goodness, they went back home and they scared Congress to death in the next 24 hours. You never saw such rapid action in your life as I got out of there. I could have gone there. I didn't know I had that done. I guess I better put this in here, take with me. And I said, the men will agree with me, but they don't do a darn thing. Well, this represented, I think, 10,000 subsidiary little clubs, and they went into those, and everybody went out. Just electric, what happened. Just electric.
I remember attending some of those early debates, and, the opposition was ferocious, and then it began to diminish.
Yeah. Well, it is a heavy fight. That's the thing I take pride in, putting the damn thing over. Anybody can. Well, you take a campaign or anything like that. There's nothing so profound in the logic of the thing. But the execution of it, that's another matter. Just like our mobilization here, I used to do thousands of miles a week following through everything that happened in this country. And then when we got the whole thing going, I went all over the world. And I was not unlike the Red Cross. I was only with the Red Cross a year, and I went 35,000 miles because I was up against a difficult situation. But Vandenberg, he was just the whole show when we got to the actual movement of the thing. I used to meet him at Blair House. I didn't go to his office, and he didn't come to mine. And we would meet over at Blair House. And at the time, the New York Times was attacking me for not having any bipartisan policy. He was just about as far off as it's possible to get and still be on the earth, you know.
That crock?
Yeah.
He just didn't know what was happening.
Well, he was profound in his own knowledge, and he didn't know a damn thing. Vandenberg and I were just handling this business, and he was marvelous to work with. Unfortunately, he thought I was, so the combination. And right, funny, he went to Brazil with me, Tom Connolly and Vandenberg, and that Jewish congressman that was chairman of the House Foreign Relations, Foreign Affairs Committee.
You mean Sabbath? Not Seven.
Oh, no, he wasn't.
He did check.
This fellow, I think, was mixed up in the Jeffersonian Mount Vernon thing afterwards. Oh. Anyway, he was chairman of the committee. He went down with us, too. And they wanted him to talk down there. And he wanted $500 for the talk. But anyway, when we came out of there, Vandenberg said we should never have a member of Congress on those committees. He had a terrible time with Tom Connolly. And the point was, it wasn't about what Connolly was responsible for. It was about what Vandenberg was responsible for. I divided these things up, you see. But Tom Connolly got over into Vandenberg's field, objected to everything Vandenberg was trying to do. Vandenberg got irate at me at first because I didn't move in. I just sat there and went through these things. Finally, one day, Tom Connolly said, well, if that's the way you feel about it, I will listen. I grabbed it right there, and I didn't let him get away. I sealed the whole compact in about 2 minutes.
He was an awful talker.
Well, but he was so unreasonable.
Yeah.
And I was trying to conduct this thing along. This is very intimate, and I wouldn't have it ever leak out in any way, but I was immensely flattered once by Vandenberg giving a imitation of Burns conducting a conference and my conducting a conference. I couldn't say much for Burns. All right, let's see. Right,
if you want a minute, I'll just turn it off here. I turned on.
Chapter 15, question 1. General Fuller's remark about Bradley on the Omaha beach. I can't believe any of it. It's quite contrary to Bradley. He was an opposite character.
Fuller's very critical of our whole policy. He's a Balkanite, you know. He wanted the Balkans, and then he...
It would lead me to believe that Fuller's desperately looking for something to criticize. Yeah. And he couldn't have picked a poor subject. I've known Bradley's reaction since he was a major. Question 2. I never heard of any suggestion to Bradley from Montgomery of the character described here, or in fact any of them. Bradley wanted to get ahead.
On both of these, I've said flatly that I don't believe it in my own writing, but I just thought that I'd like to get you on.
Question 4. There is no foundation for the statement. As a matter of fact, the Secretary of War, Mr. Stimson, was intensely interested in the college program and very much disturbed when I tore it apart through necessity. I think in the records you will find a memorandum from me to him in which I outline what our situation was. And as I recall, although the memorandum will definitely state this, I summed it up by saying, we either did this or we just took apart two divisions. I made it my business afterwards to see these men at a great many places in the country and explain to them what had happened and why.
On that point, I later talked to...
Our need, I might say, was so desperate that it would have been necessary to reduce the number of divisions in order to get the replacements.
Might interest you to know, I talked to General Keating, who had either the 102nd or 104th, and he was one of those that got nearly a whole regiment of these men. And he said a lot of people felt that they would ruin the outfit, but that actually they toned it up helped them on that drive to the Rhine.
The influence of the mothers in this was very profound, where their sons were taken and put into the combat thing. And I recall one mother and father writing to me in strong protest. And later, their boy was killed in France or Germany. And they accepted my explanation in spite of their great sorrow, and in effect reassured me as to what I had done. This made a great impression on me. Question 5. I really don't know. I was so busy with other things that I couldn't give a reply. Mr. Stimson made this his particular baby.
just to get it recorded here, you told me one day at when I had lunch with you about your policy of writing a letter to parents who had lost sons. Would you just say a word about that so I can have it here?
Incidentally, during the early part of the war, when we had so many losses and no victories or successes, I made it my business to write a personal letter to the parents or the wives of any of our casualties. There's on file somewhere there a book of these, which I turned over to Ms. Roosevelt. I continued this so long until the numbers grew beyond me. I might say that I tried to make the letters individual and in no way form letters. And the replies I received were wonderful in the spirit in which they were written. We spent a great deal of time afterwards in composing a card from me to the parents or wives of the men that were killed. I went over many suggestions. We were trying to get the card as personal as such a thing can be. And I do recall that there was only one person who replied in criticism of this reminder. Unfortunately, the casualties had gone beyond my personal, individual attention. I had them composed, incidentally, in a rather graphic chart in colors and sent this over to the president at regular intervals so that he himself could see just what we were suffering. These things required a great deal of time and much thoughtfulness, but they were critically essential in a war which took place far beyond our borders. Paragraph. I might say here, though this is not the appropriate place for it, that our people were all in agreement, seemingly, that the fighting, if any, should be abroad and not at home. But on the other hand, they seemed wholly unaware of the great difficulty of conducting fighting far away from home, maintaining the morale of the men at such distances, and of their own reactions to their distant sons or husbands. This was a continual battle, which had its beginning with the loss of so many prisoners following the surrender in the Philippines. There was one state, Arizona, or New Mexico, that provided one regiment, which I believe composed almost its entire National Guard. It was the only anti-aircraft regiment that had its equipment. The regular regiments did not have more than one battery to a regiment. All the rest were used in training. So it was sent to the Philippines. Well, with the capture of that regiment went the entire National Guard of New Mexico. And from then on, I was under continuous pressure from the mothers of these men. And Senator Chavez used to bring them to the War Department at frequent intervals. And I had a very difficult time. The pressure was somewhat relieved by the fact that the wife of a regular brigadier general, who was a prisoner, took it upon herself to try to compose these women's feelings, because there was nothing we could do. We tried every way under heavens to reach these men with help of some kind, but we couldn't break through the Japanese barrier. Finally, as I recall, we gave a ship to Japan, loaded with supplies, and of course lost the ship.
I'd never heard of that.
Yeah.
Now, this wasn't done in the first war, was it? This careful business on casualties and all that?
No.
I didn't think so.
I don't like to talk about that, but it was just terrible. They didn't do a damn thing of this kind.
I'd never heard of it.
And I saw the result over there in France. And the minute we got into this war, I promised myself I would not let these things occur. So much of this I saw over in France. First, as a member of the 1st Division for over a year, and later as a member of the GHQ. Now, I had instructions from the Chief of Staff on trips that he sent me all over the SOS to report to him anything that I saw that was wrong. Now, at the risk of taking some of your time, I'll explain one of these things to show how it works and why I sent General Lear to France.
Well, this is very important, this morale thing.
While I was on a lecture tour in the SOS in 1919, I was sent to talk to the 27th Division, and it had just bordered the transport, the Leviathan, and I talked to them on the boat. The resentment of this division, and particularly of its leaders, was extreme, for the reason that at Le Mans, which was the intermediate area of concentration, they had been called upon to prepare, I think, 5 copies of these reports on individuals, and to see these men were equipped with all these various things, including safety razors and everything of that sort. And they'd worked all night for days to get this done so that they could be on their way. When they reached, what's the name of that port on the West Coast there?
Brest.
Brest. They were required to do the whole thing over again.
Ooh.
And they were infuriated. And they poured this all out into my lap. I knew most of them, particularly the commander. So I talked to our general and his chief of staff at Brest. And he said they had to do this because that was the order. Then I dropped the task I was sent out to do, this lecture, and went to Le Mans and saw the general there and his chief of staff, the latter of whom was a great friend of mine. And I got nowhere there. These were the orders. I explained what was happening and the terrific effect on morale, the wholly unnecessary, profound irritation of these men going home. And the general would hardly listen to me. He didn't know me and he just treated me as an intruder. The chief of staff, though, was an intimate friend of mine, but I got nowhere. So I motored down to Tours and saw the commanding general there, and he was a man I knew, but he was intolerant of my intrusion. But his G4, within whose hands this was an old friend of mine, very nice, gentle fellow. So I tried with him to countermand this damned order. And I couldn't get action there. I've forgotten the reasons he gave me, but he had reasons. So he told me to go back and talk to them at Le Mans. I said I'd already done that, and the commanding general there didn't even want to see me. So he said, see the chief of staff, you know him. So I went to Le Mans and talked to him, and he said that he couldn't do this thing without an order from Tours. Well, I called up my friend, the chief of staff of the SOS at Tours, and told him of my lack of success there and the reason they gave. And he said he was sorry. And I remember saying to him, "You may be sorry, but that doesn't cure anything. Now I've reached the point where I'm going to carry out the orders I had, and I'm going to communicate directly with the chief of staff of the AEF, who was not only a friend of mine, but had been a student under me at Leavenworth."
That drummer?
McAndrew.
Oh, McAndrew.
Then he said, "Well, give me 2 hours." I said, "I'll give you an hour and a half and no longer." And he talked to Brest, and he talked to Le Mans, and then he called me back and said, "It's all cured." Well, I saw a good bit of this, and the thing that particularly impressed me, these were all fine men. It was a huge machine, and they were reluctant to make changes in it, which would complicate things that they didn't foresee. And though they had faith in me, knew me well, I'd been an instructor over most of them at the staff college, couldn't help but look upon me as a rather a visiting fireman. And this took place regarding many things in many regions of the SOS. I finally wrote a letter to General McAndrew. I remember I typed it out myself very roughly. And he sent this to turned this over to General Pershing, though I did not know it. General Pershing made a great many notes on it. And in most cases, he would say, do this, on the various suggestions I made. I never saw the paper until Mr. Baker sent for me in Washington and produced the paper and asked me about it. He was in a fight then with Congress defending the AEF. Now, this sort of thing was going on, and as I say, with remarkably efficient men. Therefore, I was much concerned at the reports I got from a few trusted officers of what was happening in the rear areas of General Eisenhower's command. You see, the men that were relieved from combat duty were put on duty in these rear areas. So you didn't have the most efficient people.
No.
As a matter of fact, it was quite the opposite, added to which they were all disgruntled.
Yeah.
And I sent a very splendid officer over to France, and because he'd had trouble with his heart, he was not allowed to fly. So he motored through the rear areas. And the minute he came back, he gave me this terrible report on the conditions he found. On that basis, I sent General Lear and several assistants to France. And incidentally, I irritated GHQ very profoundly.
Oh, Beetle Smith was just furious about it.
Oh, I know. I know.
He said, "They just dump garbage over here."
Well, I did send a couple of garbage papers, political papers. But Lear was not a garbage.
No.
And his first assistant was not, too. I think I got him from Iceland. I don't remember.
Well, you sent Bonesteel.
Yeah, well, Bonesteel came from Iceland.
Yes, sir. Well, he was an able man, wasn't he?
Yes, very.
He was able. Old. He was getting old. But
well, he was in command in Iceland.
Yes.
He was very able. But the point there was the headquarters, naturally, was looking ahead. They're looking to the front. They're looking to the fighting. And their rear was largely controlled by officers who were relieved from combat duty. As a rule, by them. They had a knowledge of administration that we could not lose. for that reason, they accumulated in the SOS, and also for that reason, they were generally senior, which was the main trouble in utilizing older officers. I might say the British used to have a system in their Navy that a retired admiral could serve as a commodore, and they would put him in command of convoys and things. In our Navy, they couldn't take these people without putting them in command of larger forces. So I thought that scheme was a very fine one. It didn't reflect on the individual because that was the general practice. Well, our great trouble was these fellows that had been relieved from duty as to combat were senior, were of such seniority that they took the leadership of practically every minor subdivision. And my struggle was to straighten this out. Now, as to General Smith's remark, we did a miracle in sparing him.
Yes.
We did a miracle in sparing him. He didn't know what such thing was and could be. But he got a couple of high rankers there who I spoke to you about, but they were capable men.
Yes. Except Lear told me that Lee never did let him operate like you wanted him to.
Lee. Well, I know Lee was very jealous of power. And
wouldn't give him any staff. It wouldn't give him any cooperation.
Lee was, on the other hand, Lee was had his difficulties.
Yes.
In these matters, you're dealing with so many personalities that it's extraordinarily difficult. And the most difficult duty I ever had, the most embarrassing, of course, was ignoring these personalities as to peculiarities and making them come across. And I did that in the matter of leaders. And that was a matter of honor with me because I felt that in the past that had not been done. And that was a great weakness in our system. And we had an accumulation of people at the top who were no longer capable as they should be for such high positions. And my struggles with them were very difficult and embarrassing.
Well, if you'd had a larger army in peacetime, you'd have worked these people out. But
well, the trouble was we had no elimination process. And when they got up and were passed for further promotion, they continued on. Well, they were just a drag on the whole military system. I remember Somerville coming to me and saying that I had to do something for him. He couldn't handle the SOS unless I got rid of these people because they had seniority on practically every sub-board he had. And that's when I turned in. I think I retired 900, maybe it was 600. And I was accused right away with the service papers of getting rid of all the
intelligence, brains.
The brains of the Army. I couldn't reply that I was eliminating considerable arteriosclerosis. Incidentally, this is, in a sense, not related to this. However, it is instructive, I think. I was so astonished, I'm referring now to my reference to arteriosclerosis. I was so astonished to see the changes in men. At the ages, the change took place. I found that along about 46 or 7, in some cases, the man began to change in his fine qualities. And of course, after the early 50s, the changes were more frequent. When he got near 60, they were very frequent. When it got up towards an ordinary retirement age, very few at that period properly were usable. There were very few patents. There were very few people like that. And as you went on beyond, greater was the rarity of finding a man that had retained his previous characteristics of command, control, and organization and administration. And what astonished me was to see a man that I had known. as a very able citizen. And possibly 15 years had passed. And I sent for him because I knew him. The struggle always was to get the man that had it. If you knew him, you used him. But the great trouble was to find out who had it. Who was this fellow? And I was so shocked in so many cases in sending for men that I knew that now suddenly were available where they were. And having to come to Washington and find they'd completely changed and were just no longer usable.
Mm-hmm.
And some at a fairly early age. That was so frequent that it wasn't extraordinary at all. I remember one intimate friend of mine, a fellow I was very fond of, who had been very able. And General Hull came to me because I had nominated this man for a command in France. He had just come to a post that was not of any particular importance in the United States. And he said, "I don't know what to do about your friend." I called him up on the phone. And he says, he can't go to France because the furniture is, in fact, and his wife's away. And he said, "I never heard of such a thing." I suggested he leave his aide to pack the furniture. He had a couple. And he said, no, he couldn't possibly leave. So he turned down a command in France for this reason. I couldn't believe what I was hearing. So I called him up and talked to him the first time in many years and said that General Hull had told me this. How about it? Was that a fact? And he said, yes, I can't leave here now because so-and-so's things are out and I can't go off and she won't be back for a month. Well, I said, my God, man, we're at war, and you were a general. And he said, well, I'm sorry. Well, I said, I'm sorry, too, but you'll be retired tomorrow. And I just moved him out. And he was a very dear friend of mine.
Unbelievable.
Now, that was a deterioration,
mm-hmm.
I suppose, arteriosclerosis. Now, in all of this, I was always very sensitive because I was getting old.
Yes.
And I wondered if I was functioning this way. And the man himself could never tell.
No.
But that was quite marked in so many cases. Man after man, I would find. So I began to believe my young assistants who had seen the fellow when they told me he no longer had it, if he ever did.
Because it may explain, too, this thing that you've mentioned several times, why that they got so they worried more about the two cars and the extra bathrooms.
Well, during the peacetime, there was so little command for a general. So little command. Unless he was at San Antonio or at Benning, and that wasn't very large, about 5,000 troops. Or in Hawaii, or in the Philippines, or in Panama. There were so few soldiers. Matter of fact, at one time they said you could put almost all the regular non-commissioned officers in the Yankee Stadium. There was a few of them. Well, and you were checked so severely by the War Department for all the minorities, if that's the proper word to use. I would find at Benning, I almost stopped the instruction in grenades because we had several actions from little fragments. Nobody killed or anything. But the restrictions they put on us were so severe that you practically couldn't train,
mm-hmm.
because they were so sensitive to any reaction against them if somebody got hurt. And the severity of the criticisms of the military committees and all were such that I felt that the War Department didn't show any backbone at all. And this is rather embarrassing for me because it seems immodest, but I swore when I got up there that I wasn't going to have any of that damn business. And I carried the flag when went before the committee of Congress, and I just wouldn't swallow the stuff they were trying to put out. Though I was always advised to keep the peace with this. Well, there were some things that kept the peace with them, but the boys didn't see that part. They only saw this other part. There's bound to be deterioration when there's no active responsibility. And well, I was always sort of interested in the reports of the chiefs of staff that take to November, say, to get them out. And there wasn't anything to talk about. And, that first blind report I got out was gotten out in 3 days, the whole report, which is a book. Though that was a particular reason for that haste. Now what?
But let's just go on to that 1 second more. Don't you feel that since the war, the Army has gone back to that business of being hypersensitive to criticism?
Oh, yes, very much so. They always do to a certain extent. And, of course, the position, for instance, of the Chief of Staff now is utterly different. He has so many over him. I don't know how many assistant secretaries he's got, undersecretaries and secretaries. And his power is so reduced that he's kept busy explaining things.
Yes.
And he isn't able to stride into Congress and defend himself.
But it does seem to me that they have ruined their case again and again by just hearing a little something, having rabbit ears, as they say, about ball players, and running and changing something when if they'd ridden it out for a week or so, it would have been all right.
I don't know about this now, but I always used to feel the War Department didn't defend its people.
Mm-hmm.
They just descend on you for this little thing and that little thing. And then some buster that needed to be trimmed, they didn't touch him because that was an embarrassing thing. Unless they could deal it on a generality basis, they didn't touch it.
And then one other thing. When you sent General Lear and Bone Steel over, you wrote a very interesting, fine letter. I think it's one of your great letters, because when I first saw it, I copied it, and I didn't have a place to put it in my book, but I've always remembered it. You said, "I feel that we lost our Army program after World War I because of the resentment of the men who became citizens, civilians, and voters, and I don't want that to happen again." But I do think that you were entirely right there, that that resentment has gone on and on and on. It helps to make us anti-Army, don't you?
Oh, very much so. All those restraints after the fighting create all manner of disturbances. The men are impatient of everything. They want to get back. They want to do this. And they want to do that. And there all this military repression occurs, and that was notably the case in General Pershing's command over there. Matter of fact, he turned on an extremely heavy program because of his G5's insistence, and he was rather prescient in his methods, which men never forgot. They were getting out in the cold and the wet and the slime and going through these things in some godforsaken little village, didn't have a pavement in the place, not a thing to see after dark, and this severe program, and they were embittered in a way that they never forgot.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one reason at the end of the war, when I began bringing people back, I specified that no movements were to start from the rear. But of course, we had the transportation then. We could do this from the front. And I also specified that in the first return of these commanders, they should bring a certain number, I've forgotten what it was, of men from the front line who had some conspicuous service, but you can find all that up there. It's the program Young was carrying out. And we moved them by air right from the front line and into the United States. Unfortunately, I didn't send them back, which has been hard on them, but they'd had a grand trip and sat in at all these big dinners and everything, so they could tell the fellows over there what had happened. It was all right for them, but it wasn't all right for the men remaining over there.
It still had an effect, though, because Stars and Stripes played it up, and I can remember, I was at First Army when the war ended. I was actually with 5th Corps when we went into Pilsen. But I went back to First Army to get my gear because I was staying on, and they, if you remember, were being pulled out to go to Japan. But they were given new uniforms, and they were going to fly back and parade. And it had a great effect. Mm-hmm. But to my mind, another piece of interesting psychology on your part, or understanding of psychology, was the letter you wrote General Eisenhower in which you said, a man likes to get away. And if you can let two or three of them have a jeep and some K-rations and plan their trip for 2 or 3 days, that would be a fine thing. And some did it, and it had an enormous effect. But this grew out of your World War I experience.
All these things I saw over there. You see, I toured the whole SOS, and I found on every side these things that infuriated the future citizen. For example, one thing that was the most irritating of all, in one town, you couldn't go into a cafe before 6 o'clock. In the next town, you couldn't go into a cafe after 6 o'clock. They didn't have any coordination of that. And they had a very severe man at the top, Katie Connor. It is like the training program. I always thought General Pershing made a great mistake in not having Heintzelman in charge of the training program, because he could have done it and made them all like it. Instead of that, they were just thrown into it and forced into it. And I know on the 1st Division, we were just inflamed. In fact, it almost smashed my career. I got so mad, and I was young. I talked too much, and I would have been many things if I'd kept my mouth shut. But I was so infuriated by what was going on. Well, all this was a profound lesson to me, and particularly that trip all over the SOS. I don't know how, it took me a month or more, and I saw the whole business. I just gave you one example of the difficulties of getting these things straightened out. And so my mind turned, in Eisenhower's case, to try to avoid this sort of thing. I'll talk to you at length later about the awful mess we got into because our plans were so beautifully laid at the end of the affair. And the twist of the Japanese surrender just turned everything upside down. Everybody was in the wrong place, and we just had the devil's own time.
I've often thought that from the standpoint of everything naturally but casualties, it would have gone so much smoother if you'd have had another year of war.
Well, if we'd have had a month.
Yeah.
1 month would have changed the whole thing. But actually, it caught us. The thing was beautifully arranged.
Mm-hmm.
In every way, every the things that happened. And bang, this thing occurred. Well, it caught everybody in the wrong position. The men that were home, had been sent home, were the ones that should have stayed in Europe.
That's right.
The ones that they were going to the Pacific, you see, because they had enough service to perform. Instead of that, here they were home, and they wanted to be released.
And the pressure was enormous.
The whole thing was just a twisted affair. Everything was exactly wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Or had it had been, it was beautifully planned, it had been right. But the perfection of the plan was its destruction. And you just couldn't deal with it. Well, someone said, you ought to know the war is going to end. Well, we didn't know the bomb was going to go off.
Or to have the effect that it did.
Well, we were calculating on that. If it went off the way they said it would, we thought the shock would be enough for most anybody. I think those things where we... you take the preparation for the schools in Europe.
Mm-hmm.
Those were tremendous. I think we had 3 million volumes. Or some tremendous number.
I know there were.
In Paris. I insisted that the selection of the instructors should be such and such, and everything should be such and such. All this was set up to go, and of course the top blew out of it. And afterwards, when I was in China, and I read these terrific performances of the troops in Europe, at least they were getting an awful press back here, back home. But I didn't follow it very closely. Matter of fact, it wasn't until a year later that I discovered they'd named a bridge over the first bridge over the Rhine for me.
Yeah, that is.
That bridge up there.
It's near Dusseldorf.
Anyway, they named it for me. I didn't even know it for over a year.
Yeah, there's a Patton Bridge and the Marshall Bridge and so on. I've crossed it. It's not too far from Cologne.
Mm-hmm.
But another time, I want to go into this very thoroughly because Many people assume, I've seen it many places, Marshall is an old-time Pershing-type disciplinarian who put above everything else this ramrod discipline, and your approach has never been that. I mean, you wanted him to be...
Well, it's been just the opposite.
To been right, but not that.
I remember just before the Battle of the Bulge, I was up in Holland, I think it was, just above the Bulge. Mm-hmm. I've forgotten that name, that big resort up there. Ends with a start, S-T-A-R-T.
Maastricht.
And the men were terribly tired, and there's been no relief for them. We couldn't move these other divisions in because there weren't any supply. So I proposed first that, while I was over there, that they bring the new troops forward without their equipment. That would reduce the carriage and everything of that sort, or the gasoline consumption, and only allow them so many jeeps or whatever it was, and relieve these other troops that are so tired, and move them back, because they've been fighting since June, and they were just worn out. Then I proposed that they take Maastricht and those other resort towns, and do them all up as a resort place for soldiers, and pretty girls, and everything of that sort, and no military police in sight. That was to be done, because I ordered it to be done. Well, then just about then, bang, came the Battle of the Bulge within about 10 days or 2 weeks. But they were not doing anything about it, and the men were just exhausted.
I didn't know that you had ordered that as a result of it, but I was up there on the Belgian-German border, and that had begun to happen. I'd go up to interview people, and they'd say, well, the men you want have just been taken back 10 miles. They're going back, and they're going to have a bath. Warm bath, they're going to sleep in a warm place, they're going to get a change of clothes, and then the USO is bringing the show up.
Yeah.
And I've seen them come back, and they were just like
people. What made me tired was that these things weren't looked into. That was Beadle Smith's great era. He was so intent on the forward part of the thing, you see, that he didn't have somebody that would do that and could break over the restrictions, because it was a very hard thing to break over them. Restrictions, the demands were severe, and you have to be severe, but there was a chance here to modify the thing, you see.
Well, and then Lee tended
it's
to
it's very
be.
Difficult for me to talk about these things, so it looked like he puts me in the position of knowing it all, and the other fellow didn't, but the point was I'd seen all this. I've always been in the habit of drawing conclusions, and I'd seen all these things happen. And sometimes I made General Pershing perfectly furious with the thing. And,
this is most important from the standpoint of I hope that one whole batch of this material can be used by the service schools on leadership and on this sort of thing. So sometime when we finish the basic questions, I'd like to go into this as a series.
Well, you'll have to play it largely in order not to put me in a terrible position. Largely from the point of view that I saw all this.
Yes.
Well, and I fortunately was in the habit of drawing conclusions. And I was determined it shouldn't happen again.
Then another thing. I have seen your directives and all that, but for a long time, suppose it was something that somebody in your shop drew up and you merely signed it, when it's quite clear that it came from your past experience. It's awfully important that young officers, I think, know that people like yourself value and put great stress on this looking after morale instead of just merely the spit and polish type of inspection.
Oh, this thing of the hazard of the sticking to the 90 division basis, no, that was not the hazard. The hazard was having badly trained divisions. Patton could never have carried out his performance if we hadn't had highly trained divisions. And you couldn't have highly trained divisions and keep watering them down in order to maintain a very large number. Question 7. As to the Carthage debate, I don't recall, just the situation there, except that Churchill was just taking command, and Wilson was not able to control the thing at all.
He wasn't.
But Eisenhower was at Carthage. Mm-hmm.
Wilson wasn't a tremendously able
man. No, that was a bad choice. Matter of fact, Dill told me that Wilson was the ablest one. Maybe he was the best we could get. And poor Wilson, quite evidently, was trying to imitate Dill with me. And I didn't rise to it very well, I'm afraid. Question 8. Oh, incidentally, on question 7. Churchill took able advantage of the conservatism of staffs control, and that plays quite a part in the approach to avalanche and things of that sort. Anzio and all. He was strong for action. And of course, the staffs are conservative. And the commander's got to be pretty conservative. But he was pushing for action. Well, I was always pushing for action. But I didn't push him over the head the way Churchill did. Part of my thought was I wanted Eisenhower to feel that we were always behind him. We might push, but we were behind him. I know we pressed him to move to France and take command over there before his communications were ready, and he said he found himself out in an orchard with no communications. Well, as a matter of fact, that was politically necessary. The pressure was getting so great on this end that we were letting it all go to somebody else, that we had to take cognizance of that and get some action. So we pressed him to go ahead of the time that he thought he should go, which was when his communications were all established. I would use my influence here to agree with your desires. I merely wish to be careful that localitis is not developing and that the pressures on you have not warped your judgment. As to question 8, my worry was in regard to Churchill and the British Chiefs of Staff. At Malta, we had a very acid meeting. And Smith came on. British put great pressure on him. They were opposing the previously agreed upon plan and General Eisenhower's procedure, and in particular the advance to the Rhine. And in describing the advance, the Americans on the combined staff had let themselves in for a British term, close on the Rhine, which Churchill seized and whipped the whole affair with. Smith was trying to explain that it was a British expression, but to me it is sort of a Gettysburg address stuff, not a simple statement of what you wanted. At this meeting, having heard from Smith, the result of some of his conversations with the British. Who's the British chief of staff?
Brooke.
Brooke was presiding for the British. I was presiding for the Americans. Said the British chiefs of staff were very much worried by the influence on General Eisenhower of General Bradley. And I think he mentioned General Patton. And I said, well, Brooke, they're not nearly as much worried as the American chiefs of staff are worried by the immediate pressures and influence of Mr. Churchill on General Eisenhower. The President practically never sees General Eisenhower, never writes to him. That is, at my advice, because he's an Allied commander. And we're deeply concerned by the pressures of the Prime Minister and the fact of the proximity of the British chiefs of staff. So I think your worry is on the wrong foot. We had a terrible meeting.
But I remember that you insisted on reworking the cable that was sent to Eisenhower so there would be no question about the fact that you backed him. I've forgotten the exact wording of it, but you rewrote part of it.
Incidentally, whenever the I is in it, it's mine. I wouldn't allow anyone else to use an I for me.
That's most important.
For instance, that was used freely early in the game. But long towards the last, before we went into the Rhine and times like that, I would recall a cable if I found the personal pronoun I in it, and I hadn't personally okayed that particular thing. And I noticed this one little statement I just read has two I's in it.
It is always interesting to watch his action after he'd gotten one of these rather stiff cables in which you said, we're behind you 100%. And an hour or two later, he'd see Churchill and he'd just hit him hard.
I don't remember the dispute about this date of June 6th.
Well, that was that debate in March and April when we kept arguing here there was enough stuff there to do both of them.
Mm-hmm.
Eisenhower said so at first, and then finally, under pressure from Bradley and Montgomery, he said, well, I'd rather give it up and have a strong overlord.
Mm-hmm. And have a strong overlord. Excuse me just a minute.